Thank you. Chico Power Bar Key. Grand Tirachi, Mad Bagger, Tom Key.
Chat. We'll begin by reading from the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, Volume 2, which is entitled Planting the Seed, and describes Srila Prabhupada's preaching activities in New York, 1965-1966. And this chapter is entitled Planting the Seed. So this first, this is from Chuck. I'm not sure who Chuck is, but... Is it a Chaitanya? Oh, what's... Oh! Wow, the one who put together the songbooks and did all the kirtan. Okay. Hello, Chuck. So he said, I finally found Second Avenue and First Street, and I saw through the window that there was some chanting going on inside, and some people were sitting up against the wall. Beside me on the sidewalk, some middle-aged people were looking in and giggling. I turned to them, and with my palms folded, I said, Is this where the Swami is? They giggled and said, Pilgrim, your search has ended.
Wow.
I wasn't surprised by this answer because I felt like it was the truth. Bruce and Chuck, and Bruce is Brahmananda?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, Brahmananda Ki Jai. I miss him. Bruce and Chuck, unknown to one another, lived only two blocks apart. After the suggestion from his friend, Bruce also made his way up to the storefront. Bruce, I was looking for Hare Krishna. I left my apartment and had walked over to Avenue B when I decided to walk all the way down to Houston Street. When I came to First Street, I turned right and then walked along First Street, came to Second Avenue. All along First Street, I was seeing these Puerto Rican grocery stores. And then there was one of those churches where everyone was standing up, singing loudly and playing tambourines. I remember those. I used to live in the Lower East Side, and I remember, back in the 80s, it wasn't really around this time, but
right.
Same scene. It was like these botanicas and people hanging out, and I can, not much change from 1966 to 86. Now it's a whole different place. Now it's all gentrified, but it could be tough. I mean, especially if he was living in Alphabet City. You know, Avenue A, Avenue B, all that. It was like rough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So these were enterprising, or they were brave young men and women to kind of live in that area, just.
Yeah.
Seeking whatever they were seeking at that time, a different way of life, creativity, self-expression, spiritual, whatever it was that they were looking for. You know, the young people who moved to that region, that area of New York, weren't looking after life's simple comforts.
Yeah.
You know, so and they were very adventurous too. A lot of them would just hitchhike around the country or go off to Europe or go off to, Raghunath Swami just was hitchhiked basically to India. You know, there was no safe little tour pack for them to go on. They just went. So, you know, these were the kind of people that Prabhupada needed to start his mission. He needed people who were brave, who were adventurous, you know, willing to kind of like play it by hook, you know, just to, what's needed? Okay, this is what's needed, you know. Creativity was very much needed because Prabhupada had embarked on something that never had been done before.
Yes.
There was no chartered path for what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a chartered path for established Indian swamis, you know, like Vivekananda and Radhakrishna, Dr. Sarvapalli Radhakrishna. You know, they kind of had their established path. They found some rich people who set them up with these nice apartments and maybe established these centers, you know, these Vedanta centers, and they're really nice, these nice neighborhoods, and, you know, rich, you know, very intelligent people who kind of didn't really let it transform their lives. You know, they still had their wine, they still had their Mozart, they still had Shakespeare, you know, they still had their quote-unquote material way of being. Prabhupada wasn't going to settle for that. Prabhupada wanted to give Krishna. He wanted to transform people's lives. He wanted to create a revolution. Prabhupada, you know, he's a very, I say, aristocratic in his demeanor. You know, he's very serious, very grave. But he was a revolutionary. He wanted to establish something completely unprecedented in his Krishna consciousness movement. And if you're going to embark on something like that, you need people who are willing to transform their lives.
Yes,
who are looking for something.
99.9% of the population.
Yeah.
They're willing to just dive into the pool and go for it. They were very great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Brahmananda, who's speaking here, his brother, I forget his brother's name. He's also a devotee. But Prabhupada was challenged by an Indian, one of his Indian, you know, people. He's saying, you know, it's so easy for you to establish temples in India. We're already Krishna conscious. Why don't you go to one of these Muslim countries and establish a temple there? So he sent Brahmananda and his brother to Pakistan. And after a short while of preaching there, they were thrown in jail. And eventually, somehow, they were let out, and they went back to India, and Prabhupada sent them back. But, you know, he sent Tamal Krishna Maharaj to China. And, you know, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj already had a successful preaching campaign with a Radha Damodar bus tour. So he was all set with that. He was doing great with that. That was a great success. Prabhupada said, hand it off to someone else to carry forth. I need for you to go to China. And you know, in China and India, they're like neighbors, but boy, there's a bigger divide between China and India than was even with Europe and India. You know, just culturally speaking, sensibilities, and so forth. So, you know, just go to, you know, there was devotees who went to Africa. Just, you know, go. Yeah, and not South Africa, which was a colony and has a lot of European dulch, you know. No, they went to, like, Kenya, you know, all these places. So,
Kenya.
So. And I remember it was Jagat Guru Swami, who later is now known as Narasingha Maharaj. After his preaching tour in Africa, Prabhupada gave him sannyas. And I remember seeing the picture of him, Prabhupada's handing him his danda, and he's taking the danda from Prabhupada, and his arms are like skin and bone. He's like a skeleton with a little bit of skin wrapped around it, taking the danda. Because when he was there was nothing for him to eat. So he just, I mean, maybe a potato or something here and there, but so most of us would be like, a couple days of this, we'd be gone. Back on the plane. But. So, I read these stories of Prabhupada's early efforts of preaching and just these people, these young devotees who took up Krishna consciousness. And they really were, you know, the vanguard. You know, they were like the first to go into battle. And you know, even going to American cities, you know, going to Detroit. You know, the 60s may not have been so bad, but, you know, some of these places I went to were pretty rough.
Detroit's always bad.
Yeah.
Detroit never changes.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have this beautiful temple there. They have this beautiful, the Fisher Mansion.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but they would go around the country and start, you know, they'd go to the city and just start chanting on the street, and people had no idea what they were doing. So, anyway, it always, yeah, it does my heart, melts the heart a little bit to hear about these stories. So, perhaps we should start the Bhagavatam classes, running a little bit late. So, yeah, maybe Srila Prabhupada ki. Grantrad Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'm not really sure what verse we're starting from, but the mark was on the 23rd verse, which is starts with, after speaking like a madman. Is that the...
What about
the first line of the 23rd verse is, after speaking like a madman this way, Maharaj Bharata got up and went outside.
No, we didn't read that.
Didn't read that? Okay. All right, so...
But I don't
so, there's a line that says, the deer exactly is exactly like a prince. And then the other line is, alas, the small deer, while playing with me, is seeing... me feigning meditation, closed eyes. I think we'll just start with that verse and maybe just keep reading the text. Is that fine? Yeah, so we'll start with verse 23, and I'll just read the Sanskrit in translation.
How about 20?
20? Okay. Sure. Sure. I don't want to gloss.
Okay. The deer is exactly like a prince.
Yeah. Okay. Shishi Radha Gopi Vallabhati. Shishi Jagannath Swami Subhadra Ki. Shishi Gaurita Ki. Okay, so verse 20. Okay. So I'll read the Sanskrit and translation. Api svedakrata sukritim angatya. Mam sukha ishati harina raja kumaro vidvata ruchira darshaniya nijamri gandaraka vinodar asano tasham svanam apanunam. Translation. That deer is exactly like a prince. When will it return? And when will it display its personal activities, which are so pleasing? When will it pacify a wounded heart like mine? I certainly must have no pious assets. Otherwise, the deer would have returned by now. Purport. Out of strong affection, the king accepted the small deer as if it were a prince. This is called moha, illusion. Due to his anxiety over the deer's absence, the king addressed the animal as though it were his son. Out of affection, anyone could be addressed as anything. So, this is what we call delusion, material attachment. And when we speak of the term faith in Krishna consciousness, it means giving of one's heart. Shraddha, you know, giving the heart. So, if we have faith in the personality of Godhead, that is called Shraddha. Otherwise, we place our hearts into things which ultimately will let us down. And so the king, this King Bharata Maharaj, who, for all intents and purposes, was a very wise man. You know, he was not a silly person. You know, he was not a sentimentalist. He was a king. Kingdom was so great, it encompassed the whole planet. You know, the planet's known as Bharata Varsha. You know, India is known as Bharata Bhumi. Even still, it's known as Bharata. And this is the Bharata. So he wasn't a silly, small-minded person. Still, no matter how great his intelligence was, he was captivated by this little deer. You know, he saw himself as the deer's protector. The deer, as a baby, was in a very, very vulnerable position. And the goodness of his heart, he went and saved and protected this baby deer and tended to it and raised it and nurtured it and did a very fine thing. You know, he did a good thing by doing that. But his heart got captured. He didn't protect his heart. He protected the baby deer. He didn't protect his heart. And by projecting this fatherly attachment to this deer, he developed an attachment, and his mind became absorbed. The verse in Bhagavad Gita, and I can only give the English translation, we have to find the verses, but it says, whatever we meditate on, we become attached to. And whatever we become attached to, we develop a very strong desire for. And whatever we develop a strong desire for, we become angry. It causes frustration. And in that frustration, our intelligence is lost. And by losing our intelligence, we fall into the material ocean. So you see...
Verse chapter 2, verse 36.
Thank you. So we see that process, you know. And so, you know, the baby deer required attention. You know, infants, young children need attention. You know, mommy, daddy, mommy, daddy, pulling on the skirt. I need this, I need this, I need food. You know, they call, sometimes babies are known as little Napoleons, right? Because they need, and I want it now. They're not going to take no. So as a baby deer, he pulled his attention. You know, he wanted, so the king, Bharata, was trying to gauge his meditation. But the deer would come and, you know, butt his head and distract him. And he found this endearing. He didn't become angry. He actually found it endearing. And he developed this deep, affectionate bond with his deer. Fortunately, Mukta corrected my miss. Sometimes you hear these stories and you kind of forget the detail. While looking for this deer, he fell down, got into an accident, and the baby deer returned to him. And he was looking at this deer. And he said, you know, like a son, like a deer was looking over him like a son would over a father. But the deer couldn't help him. Couldn't save him from death. Couldn't give him liberation. You know, the deer couldn't chant Swaha or Hare Krishna Maha Mantra in his ear. So, again, I know I've stressed this point before, but I think it's worth mentioning again, always important to surround ourselves with devotees. And I've seen, very practically speaking, in my life, the power and the efficacy and so important to have devotee association, especially in the later stages of one's life. Sometimes people think that as one gets older in life, they should do what they call nirjan bhajan. You know, and nirjan is oftentimes translated as away from people. You go off to the woods by yourself and you do nirjan bhajan, and this is what Bharata Maharaj did. But actually, it's described by Acharyas that nirjan bhajan means not in the association of materialistic people, but in the association of Krishna conscious people. That's actually what nirjan means.
It's not literally alone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're in a situation where you're surrounded by nonsense. You know, sometimes we go to these family reunions and it's just a bunch of nonsense. Or we go on these business trips and it's a bunch of nonsense. Then, yes, you're better off kind of being off by yourself a little bit and chanting and so forth, because they're not gonna be helpful to you. But better than that is actually to take shelter in the association of devotees. Same thing with any activity. Speaking. You know, there's this vrat, mauna vrat, a vow of silence. Well, for devotees, we actually do something better. We actually speak about these spiritual topics. That, for us, is actually real mauna vrat. Yeah? That it's real silence means speaking about Krishna, because it means that it's devoid of any materialistic or even jnana, impersonal conception. Rather, we speak about pure devotional service. So, there are some traditions, even in a Christian tradition, They take long vows of silence. Thomas Merton was a monastic, and he took a vow of silence for years. Like 15, 20 years, something incredible like that. And he said that once his vow was done, he couldn't stop. He couldn't stop talking. He couldn't shut the guy up. He's like, and he got very prolific with his writing, and he had a lot to say, and he had any lot to share. He even wrote the one of the forewords to Prabhupada's first edition of the Gita. That blurb we have in Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, as it is now, like they have little statements from different writers. The one that's from Thomas Merton actually came from a whole introduction that he had written for the Gita. So he had to have that kind of service given to him, even though he was hired by the Macmillan Publishing Company to do so. But the point being is, yeah, you can take a vow of silence and just not say anything for years. Better than that is to speak about Krishna. So same thing with company, and especially if we chant japa or any type of spiritual activity we do. If there's no one around who's a devotee, and no one you can make into a devotee, yes, maybe it's better off to kind of just recluse yourself and chant your rounds and so forth. But if there's an opportunity to engage with devotees or to make devotees, then that's a higher principle. That's actually more beneficial. Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu Sangha, Sarvas, Shastrakai, Sadhu Sangha, Lava Matra, Sarvasiddhihai. Yeah. That the Vedic scriptures stress Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu Sangha. Always take the all perfection can be attained. Even it said that you can take 1,000,000 baths in the Ganges River, but that will pale in comparison to a moment's association with a pure devotee. And we see, very practically speaking, we read in Srila Prabhupada's pastimes, devotees who just meet Prabhupada. I knew in a story once, a friend of mine who's a devotee knew someone who saw on a flyer that there was a Swami coming to speak at the school he was at. And he says, oh, okay, I'll go hear from this person. I'll know what this is or who this is, but yeah, it's something different. You know, he was in college, something new. And he smoked cigarettes. And so there were he was in the hallway coming in. He had a cigarette in his mouth, lit. And he heard Prabhupada say, put that out. His taste for smoking left him right then and there. He never touched a cigarette since. He didn't submit to Prabhupada as a guru. I don't think he even stayed for the whole program. But by just him hearing from Prabhupada, put that out. His taste for cigarette smoking left altogether. And for those who are ex-smokers, and I'm an ex-smoker, it's hard to give up that taste. Once you get hooked on cigarettes, it's like worse than heroin. So, but Prabhupada would have that effect on people. Just even a simple statement. It wasn't a spiritual realization. It wasn't, chant Hare Krishna. It wasn't anything profound. It was just one simple thing. Put that out. Still, the potency of his words went right to his heart and completely changed one feature of his life. He may have done other things, but still, we see. And all those, Prabhupada started a whole worldwide mission by people just meeting him. People come to hear from him. Prabhupada, and his first programs were not nearly as elaborate what we have now in our Krishna consciousness, in ISKCON. You hear about the early programs, Prabhupada, it was just, he would sit down, he would speak for maybe about, 15, 20 minutes on Bhagavad Gita or about chanting. He'd take up kartels, he would lead kirtan, and then Prabhupada would serve out the prasadam that he himself had prepared. And that was the program. That was it. Then are things like Jayadwani prayers and deity worship and Jayarada Madhava and so forth became more formalized as time went on, as people knew more. You know, at that time, devotees, there were discussions like, okay, I know Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. How's the rest of that mantra go? You know, and I can emphasize, because when I met the devotees, I didn't know the mantra either. I actually had to walk down the road with the card they gave me. And I had to refer to that card for quite some time until I actually memorized the Maha Mantra. Now for us, the Maha Mantra is like breathing. And, you know, for Amarnath Prabhu, you grew up with this, so you probably came out of your mother's womb chanting Hare Krishna.
I don't
want to
say what I came out of.
But, you know, because you have that samskar, that secretes, you know, that quality that's built in. But for many devotees, especially those of us who were born outside India, this was all brand new. And even the concept of pure devotional service is a little unusual for those of us in the West, because our religion is either basically a salvationist, which is basically my body, you know, like we just want liberation. And heaven for us is just, there's no definition. You know, you see in the cinema and in paintings, the depiction of heaven is just like clouds and maybe you hear some harp music, you know. Maybe you get a set of wings, but you don't really fly anywhere. You just walk around with wings. Or it's actually a reward-based, you know, karmakanda. You know, it's like if you do this, you get this. You know, if God likes you, he'll protect you from your enemies and he'll smite your enemies. You know, there's a lot of that in the Bible. Or if you do this, if you do this good thing, God will reward you with wealth. If you do this bad thing, you'll get a famine. There'll be, you know, locusts will come. You know, whatever, you know. And so karmakanda and jnanakanda is pretty much all what we find in most of the world's religions. And most people, and so this idea of pure devotional service, of ahaitoki bhakti, unmotivated pure devotional service, only for the pleasure of God. We live only for the pleasure of the personality of Godhead. That idea is radical for a lot of us. Because what about us? What about me? Where's my reward? But if we live for the pleasure of the personality of Godhead, and somehow or another, by some effort, or by some, you know, offer a leaf, a flower, something, if we do it with love, and Krishna is pleased, we receive a happiness that cannot be described, cannot be compared to anything that we experience in this world. Somehow Krishna is even just slightly pleased. Or even if the servant of the servant of the servant of the devotee of Krishna is pleased. You know, if the spiritual master is pleased. Yasya prasad bhagavat prasad. So prasad means mercy, but prasida means pleased. So the two words can be used not interchangeably, but prasad, mercy, comes when they're pleased. You know, mercy comes. So even if we, especially if we please our spiritual master, a little, somehow they're pleased by our efforts, then Krishna is pleased. And if Krishna is pleased, we receive unlimited happiness. And that's a very, very unusual notion. Service is there maybe to humanity or to the animals. Like Saint Francis served the animals. He protected the animals. And he also served his humanity. He set up pretty much, I don't know, historically, the Food for Life, first Food for Life program. But he kind of did. I mean, part of his service that he developed in his communities was feeding the poor, inviting people to come in. And their communion just wasn't a wafer and a sip of wine. It was a whole meal. So this conception of service to others is certainly there. You find this in many world religions, and you find this also in the Vedic culture. I remember once a disciple of Prabhupada asked him, and he was brahmachari, and he took up married life. And he asked him, he said, Prabhupada, what should a married person, as a householder, what should I do? What should be my service? And Prabhupada said, every day you should go out in the street and ask, is anyone hungry? And if anyone comes to you, you should feed them. Well, he wasn't thinking that. He was thinking about, like, having kids, what he should do for his work, you know. And he's like, no, Prabhupada, what should I do? He said, no, Prabhupada said, every day you should go out in the street and you should ask, is anyone hungry? And if someone comes to you, you should feed them. And that's Vedic culture. And I know many, many, not even devotees, just people who traveled in India. Not so much in the cities. Although if you're received by a devotee or an Indian, they'll treat you like a king when you come to their homes. But I know many people, as they travel and they go through a village, when it's around mealtime, people will come out and they'll say, have you eaten? And they're like, well, no, yeah, is there a restaurant? Is there, you know, like, no, come. And they'll bring you into their home and they'll feed you this very wonderful meal. In some cases, I know some people who had, you know, they came in, they washed their feet. They fed them the very nice meal and then gave them a bed to take a nap in. You know, like, they're like a lost long relative. And this is culture. This is actually, Chanyaka said that the sign of a cultured person is that their sworn enemy can come to their own home and they'll forget there was ever any animosity because you'll be treating them so nicely. He said that's actually the sign of a cultured person. So I don't even know how we got to this point, but kind of on these tangents. But this is culture, and this idea that, getting back to the story, it's very natural, very understandable that this King Bharat would become attached, because in our own lives we see we come very attached. We have our own pets. And you see how families come very attached to, you know, Rufus or Snuggles or whatever we call our book. You know, we become very attached to these personalities because they're jivas. You know, these little jivas who are embodied in these particular forms. And we try to relate to them on some level, and we anthropomorphize. You know, we project our own qualities onto them. So King Bharata was thinking this little deer was like his son. And this deer was thinking, oh, this is my mother. This is my mother. This is my father. Because King Bharata was all this little deer knew. So at the time of death, King Bharata was lying there. The deer was looking at him. He's looking at the deer. And neither of them could help each other. Better we keep ourselves in the company of devotees. In the beginning of our lives, in the middle of our lives, and certainly at the end. So I think I'll end here. It's about 9 o'clock. Does anybody have questions, comments, realizations they'd like to offer? I think we'll end here then. Garancha Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Shri Abhay Charnavinda Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.